You're listening to The Local Maximum, episode 236.
Time to expand your perspective. Welcome to The Local Maximum. Now, here's your host, Max Sklar.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. You've reached another Local Maximum. We have Aaron today. Aaron, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty good.
You know, if you told me like an hour ago we would be recording this, I'd be like, no way. I am about to completely collapse after my trip back, drive back from Connecticut. But somehow I am, and it was so hot today. I've had brain fog all week. I don't know about you.
Well, your lack of performance is unacceptable. The viewers demand more. You got to step it up.
All right. Well, today we have a few news stories. I didn't build expertise on any of these issues, but I think a lot of these stories raise questions and raise issues that we're going to maybe talk about on The Locals. And then we have a probability distribution of the week, which is kind of cheap this week. But hey, we got to get through.
Now, there wasn't one last week, right?
Oh, no. Yeah, I'm not doing them with the interviews. Okay. I mean, I guess I could do them with the interviews.
I was just making sure that I didn't miss something there.
Okay.
So this quick will be update. Number two.
Yeah, quick update on an old story that we were following. Got to find which episode that was, because it was a very recent episode, I think like three or four episodes ago, on Blake Lemoine, the Google engineer who said that their Lambda chatbot is sentient. Right, that was episode 230, so about a month and a half ago. And, update is he was fired by Google. Google claims that, they worked with him on the sentient stuff, which they say is, it's a bunch of crap, but they say we find the allegations to be completely unfounded, talk like that. They cite their reasoning to be security leaks. He was leaking information about how the system works that he shouldn't have been leaking. Fine. I can't help but notice the long string of public layoffs at Google due to some kind of festering crazy culture at Google, but that seems to be the way it is. Anyway, I just wanted to update on that article. I don't have much to say.
The only hot take I have to drop on that is that he managed to secure legal representation for the AI, but he apparently didn't think through the repercussions of his involvement. And I'm sure he has legal representation now, but it doesn't sound like he saw this coming.
Who's the legal representation for the AI?
I don't know what firm is doing it, but I remember that was a piece of the story was that, I can't remember whether he asked was it Lambda if it wanted legal representation or if Lambda proposed the idea itself, but that was a question that was asked and answered in the affirmative, I'm sure the. That legal counsel was secured via either pro bono or some sort of GoFundMe type deal. I don't think that Lambda has been hustling Nigerian print scams on the back end in order to pay for its legal services.
Hmm. Well, that's fascinating.
Although I could be proven wrong there.
I mean, yeah, so these firings and scandals are just so different at Google than they are at other companies. Like, Facebook recently, or not Facebook, Coinbase recently had somebody, who's in trouble for insider trading. Not good at all, but I could wrap my head around how that would happen. But, Google, anywhere from like James Damore to Timnit Gebru to this guy, Lemoine, just what... I asked the same question as I asked in episode 230. What the heck is going on in there? And why are the nuttiest people working on the future of AI? I gave some possible answers there. I don't want to rehash it, but that's what I want to re-ask once again. So speaking of Facebook, I mentioned Facebook because that's one of the articles out today. This is from the Wall Street Journal. There's another one coming out on, I think, The Verge and other tech press type places. Facebook shifts resources from news to focus on creator economy. So what, first of all, my first question was like, what's the difference between the two? Just a little insight into what the article says. This is based on a memo that went out from executive Campbell Brown to the company. So it's like an internal memo. They're de-emphasizing the news tab. I don't know if there's an actual tab. I guess there is, which news stories get put out. And Bulletin, which is their blogging newsletter platform, a la Substack, competing with Substack. Now, you might think, you know what? The first thing that I thought was news feed, which is a very old thing from Facebook. I mean, that is the whole Facebook is the news feed now. This is not the news feed. This is more the news tab. So this is actually kind of a more recent thing they're getting rid of, sort of a Lindy effect type situation where the more recent things are more likely to get rid of. This is something like Facebook News was started in 2019. I don't remember that, but, you know, that was to get, you know, paid news stories and I guess professional news organizations to get news into Facebook. Why 2019?
Well, I think that was perhaps part of their effort to A, rehabilitate their image post 2016 and B, to help fortify the election for 2020.
Yeah.
Was that we're going to invest in good news reporting. Given that before that there'd been a lot of accusations that the model Facebook was using for basically repost, they were getting all the clicks for news stories for other news outlets in a way that was basically intercepting all of the ad revenue that New York Times or whatever outlet would have liked to have captured.
Right. I do think that the political angle is a factor here. And it's kind of interesting now that the election is over, it's more easy for them to kind of say, all right, this is not making us a lot of money. Let's slowly back off. But let's look, there are other angles to this. I mean, one of the things they are saying is that, a lot of places internationally are like other countries are passing laws that makes it very expensive to them to provide the news. They're saying they have to pay for it. They have to pay certain amounts for it. I wonder if those types of laws are having an unintended effect of kind of depriving these news sources of exposure in Facebook, because now Facebook just taking them out.
I'm trying to remember if it was Australia or another. I think it was somewhere in the Pacific region that had passed a law along those lines, and Facebook basically said, okay, fine, no news in that country. It's too complicated. So if you want news, you can't get it through Facebook. Exactly to what you said, that maybe putting it in terms of exposure isn't the right way to couch it, but essentially everybody's gotten used to finding this information through the Facebook portal, so to speak, and if you turn that tap off, that people have adapted to using that infrastructure. They can't just flip a switch and go back to the way it was in 2019 before Facebook, you know, kind of started sucking all the air out of the room.
Yeah. So, I mean, that raises the question then, what happens now? What do things look like?
To mix my metaphors, you've had someone who's been on antibiotic medication for an extended period of time, and you say, well, yeah, antibiotics, probably not a great idea, might develop resistance, so we're just going to stop giving it to you. But it's not like they've developed any natural resistance in the meantime.
But it does sound like that they're going back to this creator economy. Isn't that trying to go back to 2019? Isn't that what it was? So what's it going to look like now? And who is a content creator? Like, are we not content creators here on the Local Maximum? What they're looking for, though, is not kind of the long form type stuff that we put. They're looking for short video content, something like TikTok, something like Instagram videos, which they have, they own Instagram. I mean, TikTok apparently is eating everyone's lunch. I don't know. Snapchat, the company is down 39% this week, their stock. They cite competition from TikTok as a reason. Their ad revenue is down. They launched Snapchat Plus, which everyone just calls it Plus, when they want to have a premium a service that you pay monthly for.
I mean, it worked for Apple, but I don't know if that generalizes.
Yes, but it didn't quite work for CNN. So I don't know.
So when I was going through the notes before the show here and saw this mention of kind of short form, I raised the question, you know, is TikTok is the new hotness. So that's they're trying to replicate that.
Yeah.
But you pointed out TikTok is not that new. They've been around for, what, 5+ years? And the fact that I, as someone who's not on the platform, someone who's not even on Facebook, in my late 30s, is aware of this and asking that question probably means that they've jumped the shark. kind of like when
I mean,
was there that famous J.P. Morgan quote about like when the shoeshine boy is giving you stock tips, it's time to get out of the market, or. Similarly, you know, if you're getting crypto tips from your Uber driver, it might be time for a crash.
Right.
So yeah, the fact that people like me or journalists or people who don't particularly want to be on Snapchat but have realized it's a big deal and, you know, for my business or whatever, I need to get on there are moving to join the platform means that it's toast.
Yeah. TikTok.
It's over. It's not cool anymore. I'm sorry. Did I say Snapchat? Yeah. I meant TikTok. Yeah.
No, Snapchat is out. Snapchat is, I mean, the whole idea that Snapchat is imploding, I'm like, didn't it implode like 5 years ago? This TikTok story is still going on, but nothing's replaced it. So it still is the big thing. Like, I mean, not saying invest in
it. I'm sure there's something else out there, but I'm not cool enough to know what it is. And I won't until it's way further on the hype curve.
Right. So what are these short videos are going to be? Are they going to be very informative? I can't imagine they will be. Will they be cat videos, hot takes, kind of, will they be political memes? I don't see this going in a very good direction for society Facebook always makes the wrong decision there.
So the other place that I've seen this and are you a Netflix subscriber?
Yes, I am.
So on the Netflix app, if you're looking like on your phone, I forget what they call it. Is it like Netflix Shorts or something? But basically, it's their attempt at doing like a TikTok style feed of short little clips. So a lot of it is funny moments from movies or, you know, a single joke from a comedy special. With the goal of you see something that catches your attention there and then you'll go watch the whole thing, but it's just kind of a continuous stream of that, and so they're trying to get in on whatever the secret sauce is here. And maybe I'm not the target audience, but it doesn't really work for me. So I don't know if that's a general failure or a matter of they're going after someone other than my demographic.
Right. Right. So there are two more points, one that you wrote here that we're going to make, and maybe there's the political angle too. One is the attention span that just keeps shrinking. So what did you have to say about this?
Yeah, well, so I mean, we've heard a lot about this with going from long form to shorter form in the general news reporting, but also with
Twitter
becoming the kind of the medium through which many people get their news. So Are people's attention spans just continually shrinking, or is this one of those things that people, you know, you can go back and you can find news articles talking about decreasing attention span going back to the Victorian age? And it looks like there might be some truth to it. I found a recent infographic in an article that cites that according to research in 15 years, so from 2020 to, I guess it must have been a study in 2015, attention span went from 12 seconds down to 8.25 seconds. So a significant redundancy. Not quite a 25% reduction there, but close.
Not quite a
third reduction. But
I'm pretty sure in 2000 people were talking about how attention spans have gone down since 1980. So
yeah, well, and
I don't think
it's possible. Just because we've been saying it for that long doesn't mean it's wrong. It could be that we're just continually shrinking.
Oh no! Yeah, that's what I'm saying. That's my
a bias.
Think.
But the other fun tidbit they threw out is that based on those averages, human beings in those studies now have a shorter attention span than a goldfish who clocked in at 9 seconds for focus on task. So
yeah.
I have not followed through on the sources they cited for that and read the actual study, but it's not a good look.
Yeah, yeah. So what do these changes that Facebook is making, how will they affect the elections? It seems like they're going to take their fingers off the scale, and then it's just going to be what meme lords are going to be running.
No. They said content creators, not that kind of content.
But that is a kind of content. I mean, I'm sure they also do censorship and moderation and all that. So
yeah, if they are making the decision to kind of reverse course there, with some political insight, not implying that it's purely political. I would imagine it probably has more to do with the bottom line. But this does seem like
they do have less control now.
A little bit of an unusual point in time to make that decision, as we're about to enter into the primaries for the midterms. I got my request your ballots by mail flyer the other day. So things are going to heat up. But maybe they've decided that midterms don't really matter in the same way that a presidential election does. And so this is the best timing they're going to have to try and distance themselves from the mess that was news reporting on their platform.
Even though they can censor content creators and, do all the good stuff, not so good stuff like shadow ban and whatever, just by allowing independent content creators and making that the focus versus paid, respectable news sources, they're giving up some control. I do think that's going to have an effect.
Yeah, well,
and I do think
and maybe this is just an extension of I'm sure we've talked on the show before about Facebook's huge involvement in fact checking and how they were in a partnership with was it Snopes for a while and some other people. Mm. It sounds like they've more or less washed their hands of that. And so this may just be a further step down that path to they tried it. It cost them more than it was worth, and they just want to get away from it while they can.
That would be a good development, actually, a very surprising development, because that would be a huge, bucking of the trend that we've seen over the last 6 years.
It'll be very interesting to see if it sticks.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Another topic. This is perhaps the most serious topic we have today. Has there been a huge setback in Alzheimer's research? And is this related to the reproducible science crisis? The article here is a neuroscience image sleuth finds signs of fabrication in scores of Alzheimer's articles, threatening a reigning theory of the disease. Now, before we talk about this, I need to say I am not... people think I know everything. I do not know everything. And I'm particularly have a particular blind spot in some of these medical journal type medical type information where I have trouble interpreting what's going on. Like, I'm just not up to date on the science. But anyway, I think we could say a lot of people are talking about this article, and it seems to be significant. The author is Charles Piller. The whistleblower in question he's talking about is neuroscience researcher Matthew Schrag. And from my understanding is that they found some that at the core of research in Alzheimer's, going back to 2006 and maybe even further, there are somehow, and I couldn't figure out how those got there, manipulated images that are forming the core of the data at the basis of this research. And these manipulated images didn't occur from one study. They occurred in some different places. Calls into question this paper from 2006. The title of the paper is, I'm going to have trouble pronouncing it, A Specific Amyloid Beta Protein Assembly in the Brain Impairs Memory. So they're talking about what causes Alzheimer's. Could they have got that wrong? And could this mean many years of lost research? So if this is as significant as they say, this is kind of, this is, well, it's fascinating, scary, and sort of it very thought-provoking. The quote from Matthew Schrag is, "You can cheat to get a paper, you can cheat to get a degree, you can cheat to get a grant. You can't cheat to cure a disease. Biology doesn't care." So I found that quote interesting, and I have some takeaways on this story. I don't know, understand all the science. One of my one thing that I'd be interested in having explained to me is, well, first of all, how did these manipulated images get there? Do we even know? And then secondly, like, why couldn't this have been figured out?
So not in this specific case, but I know there have been instances of papers that people have gone through after the fact and analyzed them. In fact, in some cases, using AI to try and do this analysis and search for these particular things, but where, like, your control image and your test image, it turns out they're actually the same, that they just mirror image flipped one of them. And so what looks like a...
So you're training and test.
Not for AI testing, but I think that AI helped them identify where this happened, because it's not always obvious to the naked eye, but that the person running the test basically falsified some of their data and literally used they used the same results in multiple places and, you know, rotated images or flipped it or slightly tweaked it so that it looks like you have many instances of something to corroborate your findings, but it's actually just the same result being shown over and over again. Mm. And I don't know if that's specifically the type of thing that happened here, but that's a known failure mode that has snuck through peer review in the past. And AI may be a tool for helping to catch some of those types of things, particularly with image recognition and analysis, but it could also be a tool for making better fakes.
Yeah. So one of my questions is this related to the replication crisis in science, or is there something else going on here? Because the replication science crisis in science is that papers and seminal results are not going on to be replicated, or people are, or labs are having trouble replicating published results. And, you know, if that's true, is that even really science? And, you know, if this paper is saying something, why didn't someone try to repeat the experiment somewhere else?
And if this foundational paper was published in 2006, that would fit in the right time frame for kind of when all of this work that later went on to be to fail to replicate was being done. Although replication crisis stuff, you tend to hear a lot more of it in, like, the social sciences and less in biology. And maybe that's just because we haven't been looking, that there's potentially a treasure trove of biological findings to be overturned because of a lack of attempts at replication.
Yeah. Yeah.
But this is where having somebody who's better steeped in this particular vein of biology would be useful, because I would naively think that if they're building off of this science for further research, either that further research would completely fail because they're building it off of a false premise, or something else. There's got to be another twist to it there.
They got to drugs. They were giving people drugs that apparently didn't work eventually. So
that gets into a whole thing with pharma and effectiveness trials and studies are run there, but
I my understanding is they were reducing that protein that these guys were saying causes Alzheimer's, but it actually wasn't solving the problem. Hmm. So that's an issue.
And in a field where there is there's no really solid treatment for Alzheimer's, so they might have thought they were chasing something that had, you know, a small but measurable level of effectiveness.
Right.
But really, it was all noise.
Hmm. Hmm. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I could see that. But again, you'd like to think that this type of thing couldn't really happen. But
yeah,
I guess it could. So I think that this highlights the need for more careful epistemology in data science, more careful data science conclusions in general, which Bayesian inference can obviously help with, and a lot of other things. And of course, you know, one of the things the article mentions, image manipulation is checked for a lot more than it was in the 2000s. So there might be something to be said about, like, how do you go back and look for problems from before we check the problems? But I'm not entirely sure what to say about that.
Well, yeah, and that again is a key issue of the reproducibility crisis. It's how far back do we have to go and do everything over to know that we're on a solid foundation of science? What can we trust if there's been this this hint of doubt inserted into the entire process?
Well, I think of the solid foundation of science. Like, if you talk about quantum physics, for example, you know, you should be able to go to any university lab and demonstrate the double slit experiment. And, like, you know, physics students should be able to do that as part of, like, coursework or whatever. So it's just out on the fringes. At some point, you're in an area of science where there are so few people that you're just not getting that, I guess.
Yeah, or where the methods of experimentation are less rigorous and concrete. So again, the social science is especially susceptible to this, where if your data set is 100 grad students and you're trying to generalize off of that, I think there was recently something about the whole all the science around the effectiveness of nudges is failing to replicate.
Nudges?
I think the idea of, like, periodic reminders for something being able to reinforce it, which sounds truthy, but it
most certainly does.
And again, I haven't read deeply into this, but I did see at least one headline talking about how it had failed to reproduce. So that doesn't mean there's nothing there, but it probably means that there were some overstated findings.
Yeah. So before we go on, this reminded you of a couple things.
Oh yeah.
What?
So we talked a little bit about AI and how AI might help to identify some of these types of falsifications, but AI also has the ability to maybe make better fakes. There have been many recorded instances of people generating fake academic research papers. In fact, I found looking back all the way in 2013, looks like IEEE had to pull over 100 research papers that they were in the process of publishing because they realized that they were generated using AI that they were not actually written by the people who were submitting them, who wanted to get some sort of a publication,
So that means that some people are asleep at the switch in terms of what's getting published. I mean, this brings to mind that other guy, Peter Boghossian. I don't know if you remember that from a few years ago, where he punked mostly social science journals into publishing things that were just completely made up garbage that he posted.
They were specifically using
trolling.
Yeah, they were kind of trolling the woke there. But it points to overall weaknesses in how the peer review process works. And I think that maybe raises a question that peer review does not, even when done properly, there are some things that can't be caught by that process and require rigorous replication. And how do you ensure that happens?
So peer review is not replication.
I don't believe so. I think it's
right. So it's
literally other scientists reviewing it, and they may call out, I don't think your methods are as rigorous here, or maybe you use the wrong formula for your linear regression or whatever. But I don't think it's generally them taking your methods and then going and repeating it. That generally happens after publication, or maybe a preprint is shared in the community, but so that the replications can be accelerated once the official release is out there.
Gotcha. Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, it seems like there has to be something salvageable in the academic method of doing things. Like, you know, I know I personally am like, I've never had something peer reviewed, and it does it scare me? I mean, I kind of feel like I'm right and I don't need to hear from these bozos, but there has to be something correct about what they're doing, which has been, you know, developed over many, many years in terms of how peer review works. Or is it breaking down? I don't know. But I feel like it's a good idea in general. We're running into some limitations, let's say.
The other concern, and this is speculation, I don't know if this plays into this particular case, but if your organization, you know, whether it's governmental or an academic organization, has funded a particular piece of research, and then you're going to be more inclined to fund follow-on research related to that. And if you're a scientist who's worked on some of this research, you're going to be more inclined to, you know, go further down that kind of tunnel vision is the right term for it, but, you know, further into depth in this narrow area. And so I could see that if it doesn't immediately get falsified or overturned, you're going to have a whole cottage industry of people who are heavily invested in this specific field and type of research, and are unwilling to hear the concerns that, well, you know, what if our base assumptions are incorrect? And they say, but of course not. We've been working on this for a decade. How could that possibly be?
These types of stories, I tend to sometimes go back and question things a little too much. And then this kind of story, whenever I see it, it sort of feeds into my unfortunate tendency. And I'm just going to keep doing that.
Well, it puts me in mind of the quotation that I'm sure I'm going to butcher when I try to paraphrase it. And I don't know who to credit it to, but that, you know, science advances by the death of one scientist at a time, because the old guard has to die off for the young Turks to actually be able to get past their old ideas and raise new ones.
Yeah. Oh, well, I definitely have heard that before. could be. All right. I think we've got through this. I apologize for all the yawning. This is what happens when you do it at the end of the day of a hot week when I drove 3 hours. Let's get to the distribution of the week. So last time we talked about the categorical distribution, if you remember correctly. That is when you have a certain like finite number of events that are all mutually exclusive, and you're basically you're basically assigning a probability of each one, and the probabilities add up to one. So you mentioned something even a little bit more basic or kind of a subset of this, which is I'm going to call the uniform categorical distribution. And that is we just assign everything the same probability. So if you have a die, you assign each side 1/6 probability, 1/6, 1/6, 1/6, 1/6, 1/6, 1/6, and that's your uniform categorical distribution. You know, there could be many different categorical distributions that you could think of for that die, but there is only one uniform distribution, and so it's really a special case from last time. It's a categorical distribution where every probability is equal. So another way of thinking about it is the categorical distribution lives on a simplex. You are smack in the middle of the simplex, and you're not favoring any one. When is this good to use? The first one, the obvious one, is casino games and, like, math problems. So non-real-world problems. I guess casino games are real-world problems, but they're sort of artificially constructed. Right. So, you know, yes, you flip a coin, use the two-dimensional uniform categorical distribution, I guess, which is essentially a 50-50. And, you know, if you have a die, whatever, if you have a roulette wheel at a casino, all the spaces are equal, or, you know, same with Wheel of Fortune. You also want to use these when the problems are completely symmetric. So if you're given a math problem, a probability problem, and you have four different outcomes, And essentially, if you permute the four different outcomes in the way they're stated in the problem and there's no difference, then that's called symmetry. So there's, in other words, there's no reason to distinguish one from another. Then you could use this this uniform distribution. And should you use it as a prior, like in a Bayesian prior, like, hey, I don't know how to distinguish between these five outcomes, so let's say they're all equal, and then we'll start getting information in on which one's true and which one might not be true. That could be a way to start, but as we'll see in a minute, there are exceptions. There are not just exceptions. It probably is the exception to say that just make everything equal and make it a day. So,
well, one thing that we do sometimes talk about when we're discussing, you know, kind of Bayesian statistics is, do you have a fair coin or is it a fair die?
Right.
And so if you're trying to make that assessment, you start off with a six-sided die and you don't know if it's fair or not. It's probably best to use that uniform categorical distribution as your prior, unless you have other outside information which skews your suspicions there, and then as your data deviates from that.
Yes. Now, of course, that's going to get a lot more complicated as we go on, because you actually want to have at that point a distribution over the possible categorical distributions that represent the die or the coin. For the coin, that would be, you would use a beta distribution, which we haven't gotten to yet. That's sort of the solution there. And so right now we're talking about something where you're not trying to figure out the weight of the coin. You literally just have two different possible states of the world that you're trying to distinguish between. And so, yes, if you have a completely symmetric problem, you use the principle of indifference and say that they're equally likely. But when should you be suspicious of this? First of all, if the number of events, you have a very high dimensional case, there's more likely to be structure in there, and they're not equal probabilities. So in other words, maybe I have 100 different cases, it could be that those can be embedded in some other space, where they have some structure related to each, or they could be organized like in some of them are more similar to each other than other things. So, for example, if I'm looking for hypotheses, and there's one that looks pretty plausible, and then people give you 10 just ridiculous hypotheses that could be true, but then they're all kind of variations on a theme.
Trying to fill out the possibility space.
Yeah. You probably shouldn't rank them all as equal, especially if a bunch of them are variations on a theme, because now you're just adding extra weight to that sort of variation or that class of hypotheses. So that's a problem. And most problems are not completely symmetric, and even a small difference can kind of just throw this to the wind. So I would say be cautious in using these uniform categorical distributions unless you're dealing with a very straightforward casino type games. And oftentimes in those games, it's like, you know, it's not like you don't have to go through an entire, the only Bayesian step is going from complete ignorance to what the die is going to end up as, and then the answer. There's no in between. I mean, there might be like, if I hide what the die has and I say, if you add this to another die that I won't show you, it gets this number. And maybe you could probably make up some problem where you have some information on what the roll was before you get it.
It's a little contrived, though.
Yeah, exactly. So usually it's like, hey, I have complete indifference, it's kind of obvious to figure out if I have a symmetric problem, like this uniform categorical distribution is going to be the correct prior to use. And then usually in these kind of casino problems, it goes directly from complete ignorance to complete knowledge. I don't know what it is before I roll the die. After I roll the die, I know exactly what happened. And there's no kind of in-between where one is sort of increasing in probability and the others are decreasing. Unless you kind of see as it rolls, maybe something is like spinning. But, you know, yeah, well, usually that's the case.
Wasn't there something with Claude Shannon where he developed a method that he could observe? I don't know if it was dice for craps or if it was the roulette, the ball on the roulette wheel, where he could make some sort of observation while it was in motion, but before bets had to be placed, that would probably allow him to more accurately predict what the outcome was going to be. But that would probably be
roulette than craps. Yeah. But even in roulette, I don't think you could do that. Maybe in like kind of a poorly designed roulette board.
I'll have to look it up because I think there was something he did with like a computer hidden in his clothing and a device in his foot that he used to trigger something that he and his wife and was it maybe Feynman went and tested in casinos. I'll have to look it up and we can throw it in the show notes.
Yeah. A last thing to point out is that if you're going to have a categorical distribution on a certain number of categories, doesn't matter. Let's say K categories. If you want to think of a number, think 10 categories. This is the distribution with the maximum entropy. And the entropy is the expected information gained by finding the answer. So for example, if you were certain beforehand, if you were certain this coin was going to land on heads, and then you learn later that the coin is indeed landed on heads, you did not learn anything. You got zero information out of that. Yes, this is information theory. If you thought there was a 90% chance the coin landed on heads and you learned that it in fact did, then the amount of information gain is like the minus log of 0.9. But let's not do it in our heads right now. But it's going to be pretty close to zero at that point because you were pretty sure. But there was a 10% chance you had tails, and then you know you would have a high amount of entropy on that. You would be like, "Wow, I really wasn't expecting that." So if you want to maximize your expected entropy or expected information learned, then this type of categorical distribution is your maximum entropy. And you could think about that in terms of like data coming in from, let's say like information or data coming in. Let's say it's from a computer and you're getting binary information, or maybe you're looking at characters. If certain characters are appearing more than other characters, then that's an indication that the data could be compressed a little bit more because each character is giving you less information than it could be. So, oftentimes you have a class of distributions and you want to ask what's the maximum entropy one. And so this is the maximum entropy one. It's kind of related to, I feel like we've talked about this before, but I don't know exactly when. So it could have been in Huffman codes or it could have been in, I mean, I'm sure it was in information theory. We did an episode on that, right? That was episode, where was it? Fractional bits, episode 19. Let's go all the way back to episode 19. Yeah. With Daniel Kronovit. He was great. So related to that. All right. So simple distribution this week. I think it's good though to kind of overturn every stone in this and not try to.
So there's one other thing that I think is pretty neat about the uniform categorical distribution. And tell me if I should hold this thought for a future distribution discussion. But if you take the classic and usually the example is given in the context of Dungeons and Dragons because they have all sorts of different multi-sided die, but even if you apply it to something as simple as classic Monopoly, where no longer are you rolling a single six-sided die. There, you're generally rolling two six-sided die, six-sided dice. And so even though the results of each individual die is this uniform categorical distribution, when you are summing the results of two dice, you get a very different non-uniform categorical distribution.
It's kind of a discrete triangular distribution.
And you know, as you add more dice, even if you keep the maximum result the same, it changes the shape of that distribution. So in the classic D&D example is, do you roll one 12-sided die, one D12, or do you roll two D6s, two six-sided dies? And in both cases, you can roll a maximum of 12, but the minimums are different, your average is different, and the distribution curve across those is different. And so that has some interesting game design features. And I just think it's super cool that you can take two uniform distributions and by adding them together, you get something that looks completely different.
Yeah. So I think, part of this we're going to have to cover later, it's related to the normal distribution and also related to just summing distributions in general and maybe summing finite distributions. So I'm sure we'll get to that. But I think the core takeaway here is that uniform distributions don't add. They're not additive. So you don't get another uniform distribution if you add two together, which is I think, an important point of intuition building in and of itself. So
And anyone who's played, a game of Monopoly probably has a good sense for that, even if they wouldn't state it in the abstract.
Does something interesting happen in Monopoly when you get two ones?
I believe do doubles let you roll again, but I don't know about do two ones. No, I think it's if you roll doubles three times, you go to jail. But I don't think Snake Eyes does anything special. It's been a long time since I've played Monopoly, though.
Oh, house rules. There are some house rules here. I just searched it. When rolling Snake Eyes, a player receives $100. Okay.
I haven't done a assessment on the game theory of Monopoly, but I'm told.
But in
by
general,
people,
there's no special outcome.
I'm told by people who know Monopoly better.
But there
than
are
I
doubles.
Do, that house rules ruin the game.
Ah.
That probably the reason why everybody hates Monopoly is because you've been playing it with house rules that make it worse.
Yeah, yeah. But I don't think the regular rules, if the regular rules were sufficient, there wouldn't be house rules, would there?
Well, so. maybe we need to do an experimental exercise in this. at the next local Maximum game night.
Yes, yes, I'm sure. Well, we have our tech retreat coming up. So maybe we'll give it a try. All right. Our 20-minute episode is now 48 minutes. So I think it's time to head out. I think we covered it. I don't have any last thoughts. Do you?
Yeah, we covered the news, good and bad, and talked about a cool distribution. So that's a wrap.
All right. Have a great week, everyone. That's the show. To support the Local Maximum, sign up for exclusive content and our online community at maximum.locals.com. The Local Maximum is available wherever podcasts are found. If you want to keep up, remember to subscribe on your podcast app. Also, check out the website with show notes and additional materials at localmaxradio.com. If you want to contact me, the host, send an email to localmaxradio@gmail.com. Have a great week.
Feel the power.